Iran says its recent anti-terror operation in Iraq and Syria was in line with its international obligations and the country's inherent right of self-defense. Israel's indiscriminate airstrikes and artillery fire continue to claim more civilian lives across Gaza as the death toll of the regime's genocide nears 24,300. And Islamic resistance in Iraq says it's attacked a vital target in the center of the occupied Palestinian territories using long-range cruise missiles. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says the recent anti-terrorism operations carried out by the country were in line with its international obligations, especially under international humanitarian law. Amir Said Iravani made the comment in a letter to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and President of the Security Council. He said as one of the main victims of terrorism, Iran carried out anti-terrorist operations in line with its inherent right of self-defense under international law and the UN Charter. The Iranian ambassador added Iran's operations included targeted attacks against bases and facilities of terrorist groups in Iraq and Syria. Iravani said operation was a response to the recent Daesh-claimed terrorist attack in the city of Kerman, which left about 100 innocent civilians, including women and children, dead. He also reiterated Iran's unwavering commitment to fully respect its national sovereignty or the national sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity of Iraq and Syria. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps said it used the Khyber Shikan ballistic missile in recent operation against anti-Iran terrorist groups in Syria. IRGC said that long-range missiles were fired from Iran's southern province of Khuzestan and successfully hit terrorist bases in Idlib, Syria, some 1,300 kilometers away. Khyber Shikan, which is a high-precision guided missile, has a range of nearly 1,500 kilometers. Its optimal design and warhead ensures high maneuverability, allowing it to penetrate missile shields and counter anti-missile systems. It's a third generation of Iran's ballistic missiles, unveiled back in 2022. Iran's made considerable progress in its missile program in recent years. It, however, has repeatedly stressed that it's purely for defensive purposes and only meant for deterrence. Ibrahim Wahdi earlier joined us with more details on Iran's latest attacks on terrorist bases in Syria.
The targeted headquarters in Idlib used to be training centers, according to local sources, because terrorists were concealing these information. They are not allowing anyone near these targets, these near these headquarters, to conceal information. According to local sources, these headquarters used to be training centers for the so-called ISIS Khorasan terrorists, who used to be trained there to be sent later to the Afghanistan to the Iranian borders to carry out terrorist attacks inside Iran. The IRGC fired high-precision ballistic missiles that reached their targets, destroyed these headquarters. The headquarters are affiliated with the Turkestan party, which is affiliated also with HTS, Al-Qaeda, offshoot in Idlib, which is also cooperating with ISIS. We know that regardless of the names, the brands, it's all the same. Terrorists operated by the U.S. and Israel. Also, according to local sources, the targets were destroyed completely.
Political analyst Sayed Mohammad Marandi believes the IRGC missile attack against one of the headquarters of Mossad in Iraq's Kurdistan region was a clear message to the Israeli regime.
I think it was a clear warning to the Israeli regime that its presence in northern Iraq will no longer be tolerated. Sadly, northern Iraq has been a problem for Iran. The local government in Erbil, despite the fact that Iran helped it and saved the city from ISIS, and General Soleimani went to save the city himself with his troops, Erbil has not played a constructive role. They've allowed the Israelis to create a strong presence there, and also they've allowed terror groups to be based there. This is no secret because even documentaries are made by Western TV channels where they go to these bases of terrorist groups and watch them train and speak to the terrorists.
Political analyst Ofad Izadi says despite claims of fighting terrorism, U.S. is in fact supporting terror groups in West Asia.
The Americans claim to be fighting ISIS, so they should be thanking Iran for fighting ISIS. But in reality, we see the fact that the United States military helped ISIS move some of its troops from Syria to Afghanistan. The fact that they claim to be fighting ISIS, but whenever they saw ISIS leaders, they generally stood and watched. The fact that ISIS fighters were treated in Israel shows that we are dealing with an Israeli-American ISIS axis in this part of the world, and three entities are all enemies of Iran, and they should be because Iran is fighting terrorism.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the entire world agrees the Palestinians in Gaza are oppressed, but victorious in the face of Israel's deadly onslaught on the besieged Strip. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said that all the people around the world, whether Muslims or not, considered occupying Israeli regime as a regime that is a bloodthirsty wolf which has fallen apart and been defeated. Khamenei also hailed the government and people of Yemen for standing in solidarity with Palestinians. He said Yemenis have taken great measures inflicting damage on vital channels of the Zionist regime despite threats by the United States. Leader expressed hope Yemenis will continue their perseverance. In recent weeks, they've targeted over two dozen Israeli or Israeli-linked ships in the Red Sea, and the operations were in response to the regime's bloodshed in Gaza and its blockade of the Palestinian territory. Iran's foreign minister says that the Islamic Republic considers the Hamas resistance movement a liberation movement that fights to free its own land from Israeli occupation. Jose Namir Abdullahian was speaking with his Spanish counterpart, Jose Manuel Alvarez, on the sidelines of the World Economic Forum in the Swiss city of Davos. He said the Israeli regime has made a blatant mistake by thinking it can eliminate Hamas and the resistance in Gaza through war, emphasizing Iran opposes further spread of the war across the region. Iran's top diplomat said Israel will not be able to continue the war without U.S. support. Amir Abdullahian said fate of post-war Gaza should only be determined by the people of Palestine, warning imposed political solutions will certainly fail. He said restoring peace to the region is only possible through an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, opening humanitarian corridors and stopping displacement of Gazans, and finding a solution for an exchange of prisoners. Over 100 days into Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza, the regime continues pounding residential areas with airstrikes and shelling. The Gaza Health Ministry says 158 Palestinians are killed and 320 injured in the latest attacks. The southern city of Khan Yunis and its medical centers remain key targets of the Israeli airstrikes. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent, Israeli warplanes bombed vicinity of Al Amal Hospital, inflicting severe damage to the building and causing panic among the patients and those displaced there seeking shelter. Israeli forces then launched an intense series of raids on the city itself. Large number of casualties were reported. Overall death toll has now surpassed 24,000, most of them women and children. Meanwhile, communications and internet services have been completely shut down in wide areas of Gaza, and this marks the seventh outage in Gaza since outbreak of the war on the 7th of October. A prominent human rights group says Israeli regime is using food as a weapon against the Palestinian people in Gaza. The Euromed Human Rights Monitor says the Israeli regime is not only starving Palestinians, but also kills those who try to obtain small portions of food from UN aid trucks. The group says on one account, over 50 Palestinians were killed by Israeli drones live fire while they gathered to receive aid from one of those trucks. It says such practices are part of the genocidal crimes regime has been committing since October 7th. Euromed also has taken UN agencies to task for failing to find suitable measures for the delivery of aid to the large population in need in the war-torn strip. Palestinian Ministry of Education says nearly 4,500 students have been killed since the beginning of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza and the occupied West Bank. According to a statement issued by the ministry on Tuesday, another 8,000 Palestinian students have been injured. It says 41 students have been killed and nearly 300 others wounded just in the occupied West Bank. The ministry put number of Palestinian teachers or administrators who lost their lives in Gaza at 231. Based on the ministry's report, Israeli regimes targeted 90% of Palestinian schools and education buildings in Gaza. Now, various human rights groups and the reports have documented many instances of Israeli bombings of Palestinian educational centers. Palestinian resistance has launched a barrage of rockets toward Israeli settlements in the Negev Desert in retaliation for the regime's ongoing bloodshed in Gaza. Rocket sirens sounded in the Netivot settlement and surrounding towns. Israeli media said resistance forces targeted settlements with over 50 rockets. Now, reprisal operations are conducted from central Gaza that amid battles between resistance fighters and invading forces there in northern Gaza. Intense fighting has been reported there despite Israeli military's claims of ending its operation in the northern part of the enclave. Meanwhile, the IOF has confirmed death of a soldier who was injured in Gaza back in December. Islamic Resistance of Iraq says it fired missiles at a vital target of the Israeli regime in central occupied territories. The group says over the past few days it used the Al-Arqab advanced long-range missiles to hit Israeli targets. The resistance movement has described the attack as a response to U.S.-Israeli crimes against Palestinians in Gaza. The group previously targeted Israeli military bases across occupied territories. The Islamic Resistance of Iraq has vowed that its attacks will continue until the Israeli regime stops its ongoing campaign of genocide against Gazans. Yemeni armed forces say they'll continue to take all necessary measures to defend the country amid simmering tensions in the Red Sea over the U.S.-Israeli genocidal campaign in Gaza.
The Yemeni armed forces will continue to take all of the defensive and offensive measures as part of its legitimate right of defending beloved Yemen, and also in stressing
Sorry, added Yemen's Navy struck another ship, which is headed to Israeli ports with a number of naval missiles. That after a ship's crew did not respond to warnings. Spokesman also reiterated that Yemeni armed forces will continue to target Israeli ships or those headed to ports in occupied Palestine until the Israeli aggression on Gaza stops and the siege is lifted. Academic and investigative researcher David Miller says Israel's bid to escalate its genocidal war in Palestine is failing, and resistance groups in the region are fighting off the regime in multiple fronts.
The resistance has not depleted its stock of armaments, mostly, of course, as Qassam Brigades have been saying just yesterday, mostly homemade. But then, of course, let's remember that they're fighting on five or six fronts. They're also fighting on the northern front against Hezbollah, against the Red Sea front, against Ansarallah in Yemen. Of course, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq has been doing extraordinary things, including attacking US bases in both Iraq and in Syria, and indeed, of course, Israeli bases in the Golan Heights. So they're fighting on many fronts, and it looks to me like they want to escalate. But if they do escalate, that's a problem for them, because Hezbollah has not used anything but a fraction of its weapons, and indeed none of its medium-range missiles, which can reach the whole of the territory of what's called Israel. So they're playing a game where they want to try and pull the US back into the conflict, and they're doing that by trying to escalate. And that's a game which probably isn't going to work. The Gerald Ford aircraft carrier has left the Mediterranean. The Americans are showing clear signs of actual fear in their confrontation with Ansarallah. in the sense that they briefed Ansarallah in advance about these raids that the US and UK did, but they have not, and they've backed off on the idea of a full confrontation through this ridiculously named mission to protect prosperity. So it looks like the Americans are not wanting to escalate. It can go on longer. The resistance is holding out. The resistance is winning in Gaza and, of course, on the northern flank in Lebanon. But what their game is, I guess, is to try and pull the US in, and I think that's going to fail, and that will be very, very difficult for them.
Palestinian shop owner says the Israeli occupation forces used them as a human shield during their latest raid on the town of Dura in the occupied West Bank.
What happened today is that the army raided Dura. I was at my shop. The army asked to search the shop. He asked me to let the workers leave the shop. They searched the shop and myself. They took us outside and put me on the floor. Then he took me toward the jeeps. He told the workers to go, and he told me that he will use me as a human shield. The young people shouldn't hurl stones. You will walk in front of me. That's what happened, and he took me towards the center of the town.
The regime's forces used live fire to disperse about 100 Palestinian protesters during a Monday raid on Dura. The Palestinian Health Ministry says at least 2 Palestinians were killed and at least 10 injured during that raid. Tensions have escalated in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of the Israeli bloodshed in Gaza. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, around 350 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 4,000 injured in Israeli raids across the occupied West Bank since then. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می‌کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we made you familiar with the views of Irish professor Fred Halliday, who has made researches on international relations and West Asian issues. Today, we are going to sum up the views of those Western researchers whose views we have presented to you on the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Stay tuned, please.
Thank you.
The Islamic Revolution has been focused by many thinkers and researchers across the world due to its unique nature and the unmatched impact it has had on global developments ever since its victory in 1979. Michel Foucault was one of the outstanding thinkers whose views we presented to you briefly on the Islamic Revolution and its peerless leader, Imam Khomeini. The Islamic Revolution emerged in the age when religion had been isolated, especially in the social aspects of life. French thinkers, Foucault, did not follow his contemporaries to call religion as the opium of masses. In fact, this was the famous belief of the German thinker, Karl Marx. Foucault had indeed believed in another statement of Marx, where he had said, "Religion is the spirit of a spiritless world." Foucault considered religion as a generating, converging, and creative force, which puts forward a novel kind of discourse and method of living. The French researcher maintained that the Iranian Shah had omitted ordinary, unofficial powers like opposing political parties and groups, neglecting that this would reinforce the dispersed network of power among people. He calls the Shah and the army as the explicit symbol of power and violence against people's congregated and accumulated power. He opines that religion, spirituality, and congregated willpower, coupled with Imam Khomeini's highly influential and charismatic personality, were the core of the Islamic Revolution. In short, Michel Foucault is of the opinion that Iran's Islamic Revolution demonstrated the glory of faith and willpower and the lofty Islamic culture to the world. Ahmed Algar was another thinker who spent years to research on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. This British thinker maintained that the Islamic Revolution would have never gained victory had there not been Imam Khomeini to lead the people. He, like Michel Foucault, believed that no other group of the so-called rightist or leftist parties was able to unite people around a single cause. He says that in the horizon of Iran, there was no other person to be comparable to Imam Khomeini and his invitation. Algar considers Imam Khomeini's courage very important in making hard decisions. He refers to Imam's firm link with religious establishments and his deep attention to Islamic wisdom and irfan, which is cognizance. The British thinker gives high role to Imam Khomeini's spirituality in his confrontation with enemies. Nikki Keddie was another Iranologue and researcher of West Asian studies from the University of California. She called the Islamic Revolution as Iran's cultural reaction to the unwanted presence of the American imperialism in the country. The American University lecturer says that the high level of dependence on the U.S. during the Shah regime caused innumerable economic calamities in Iran. This led to uniting of people by Imam Khomeini to stage a great revolution to cut off the hands of foreign occupiers in various domains of the country. Keddie highlights two characteristics as the main parts of Imam Khomeini's personality, namely being uncompromising and resolute. Armenian-American University lecturer Yervant Abrahamian is another thinker who has studied on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. In his opinion, although the Shah had made economic and social developments, he had forgotten to form a matching political structure. Like most thinkers, he too believes that Imam Khomeini played the main role in bringing the hearts of people together and the victory of the Islamic Revolution. For sure, his unprecedented popularity among people from all walks of life was very effective in this regard. Abrahamian, however, pays attention to Imam Khomeini's simple way of life as another feature of his disposition, alongside his being uncompromising against the illegal and illegitimate ruler. The American University lecturer says that the Imam ably caused potential powers among people to converge on a single course and mobilize them in the struggles to topple the oppressive and dependent regime. In continuation of reviewing the opinions of Western thinkers of Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution, we talked about the views of John Foran and Fred Halliday. John Foran from the University of California in Santa Barbara focuses on the despotism of the Pahlavi regime and the dominance of foreign powers, particularly the U.S., on Iran as the two main causes of the Islamic Revolution. Reviewing the two revolutions of constitutionalist movements and oil nationalization during the past 1.5 centuries, he stresses that both movements failed due to the defeat of the people's resistance. He then goes on to say that Imam Khomeini's leadership was very effective and determining in the formation and victory of the Islamic Revolution. Irish University lecturer Fred Halliday also said in a speech in 2008 that the Islamic Revolution is the most modern revolution in the history of mankind, while it was a non-violent development. Like others too, he too is of the opinion that Imam Khomeini played a key role in the formation and triumph of the Islamic Revolution. He then continues that the transition of power after the Imam's passing away was a very great achievement in the history of the revolution and an unprecedented event in the history of Iran and the regional nations. He correctly says that the peaceful transition of power after the Imam's demise and the people's reaction to this was a prominent sign of his legitimacy and that of the Islamic Republic system. Halliday points to the ideological basis of the Islamic Revolution, such as independence-seeking, convergence of Islam and democracy, strengthening of Iranian identity, and so on, and considers Imam Khomeini's simple way of life and his honesty as the most important factors for his unmatched popularity among world leaders. A noteworthy point in Fred Halliday's views is that he seriously distinguishes between the nature of the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini and the extremist and savage views of Taliban and Al-Qaeda Salafists. He maintained that Iran enjoys a very rich and bright history and owns a very lofty cultural, economic, political, and scientific status among the regional nations.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is wonderful stimulation for our thoughts from Imam Ali al-Naghi al-Hadi, peace be upon him, the 10th infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Better than the good deed is its doer. Nicer than the nice utterance is the one who utters. More virtuous than knowledge is the one who has the knowledge. Worse than the evil is the evil doer. And uglier than terror is the one who terrifies.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how the world is a help for the believer. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here. We're talking about Islamic lifestyle on A to Z. Now, one of the things that people unfortunately have a tendency to believe or have a tendency to think is that the world in all of its aspects is something that is reprimanded in Islam. Now, on the other hand, we find that there are many traditions by the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, in which they talk about the world as a means and as a necessity. And so, in this manner, we realize that the world can actually be a great help for the akhirah and for the hereafter. Now, of course, you know, we live here in this modern world, in this modern era, and a integral part of this is that you have to go to work, you have to have a source of income, you need to make your ends meet. And so in this context, Islam has actually very severely condemned individuals who do not go and search for their sustenance, meaning they don't go and work in order to acquire an income. Now, of course, it is clear that one needs to acquire an income that is halal and is permissible. You know, one should most definitely not go and search for income that is haram. And in the present day, this can be quite difficult at times. But with the help of the Almighty Allah and a little bit of effort on our part, of course, we will find that earning a halal and permissible income is something that is not only relatively easy, but it is also quite satisfying. And so this encouragement that Islam and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam via their traditions and of course the Holy Quran, they all tell us and encourage us and point us towards going out there and earning an income and providing for our families. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how the world is a great help when it comes to the believer and, of course, when it comes to the hereafter. One of the greatest misconceptions, as we said in the previous segment, is that Muslims believe that we should be poor, that we should be disenfranchised, and that, you know, we shouldn't try to make ends meet or search for our sustenance or work hard. Whereas we find that the infallible and immaculate imams, starting from Imam Ali alayhi salam, going through all the rest of the imams, you know, we find that they worked very hard. You know, they worked in fields, they worked in agriculture. Imam Ali alayhi salam himself, he worked to dig wells. He planted orchards of date palms. And we find that all of the imams actually, in one way or the other, they were involved in some kind of physical work. And so they made their ends meet in this way. Muslims, therefore, are encouraged and definitely should go out there and work hard in order to make ends meet, in order to provide for their families, provide for their children, and give them a good life. Now, before we end the program, it is kind of important to note that the world is not the ends. The world and this kind of work is not the hadaf, it is not the goal, it is not the mission. Rather, it is just a means for us to be able to live a comfortable life so that we can better worship the Almighty Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will monitor the treacherous assassination of the martyr Commander Wissam Tawil in southern Lebanon after Hezbollah's specific operation by bombing Israel's strategic Meron airbase, which constituted the initial response to the assassination of the martyr Saleh al-Arouri in the southern suburb of Beirut. This is while the Hebrew media has followed the failure of the occupation army so far in the Gaza Strip to achieve the goals of the aggression. Add to this, of course, the differences within the Netanyahu administration, which is now threatening its continuation. Regarding these topics, I welcome the journalist, Mr. Zahir Abu Hamdi. Our warmest welcome to you, Professor. So the Israeli media watch with great interest the treacherous assassination of Hezbollah leader, the martyr Wissam al-Tawil, while he was in his car on the road to his hometown of Kibbutz Selm in southern Lebanon. To the regime, his works had caused pain to the head of the occupation. Professor Zahir Abu Hamdi, the martyr commander Wissam al-Tawil caused pain to the occupation's head for a long time while he was alive, which is based on their own admission. But it seems that he's still causing this pain even after his martyrdom through the expected response, as this Zionist commentator said.
Of course, he's a martyr who has joined a very long caravan of martyrs. It seems that based on the information that we have about the secret soldiers and secret leaders within the resistance movement, we did not know much about the nature of his work. But after his martyrdom, we knew that he was a very significant commander on the ground and the leader of a very important unit in the resistance. And most importantly, if we link the secretive issues from the political side or from a field operations side, we will find that this war is a highly revealing one in terms of technological matters, in terms of security and intelligence matters, and it seems that the two sides of the war know how to deal with each other. I mean, it is as if the Hezbollah side or the resistance knows a lot about the Israelis, and the enemy, on the other hand, has managed to gain control over phones or the internet or even monitoring and surveillance through technology. This is why, for example, we see that Hezbollah's very strong retaliatory attack was aimed at the Mehran base in Jabal al-Jarmah, a military base which is specialized in surveillance, monitoring, and aviation management, not only in Lebanon, but in Jordan, Turkey, Syria, and the entire region. Even Hezbollah's statement in targeting this base is an explanation of what this base is. They address the occupation regime and say, "I know more about you than you imagine, or more than you think." Returning to the martyr Jawad al-Tawil, this is not only the issue of the response. The revenge will definitely be painful. But we know that in the Palestinian or Lebanese resistance, every leader who is martyred comes someone after him who is more solid, more partisan, and has more motivation for revenge.
No. It appears that the response came in a statement by Hezbollah today confirming the attack on the headquarters of the northern region under occupation in response to the assassination of the martyrs al-Aruri and al-Tawil.
Not only is this base in northern Palestine the largest base, it is the headquarters of the Northern Front Command. Most important of all is that Netanyahu visited it, Gantz visited it, and Gallant visited it. This also shows that Hezbollah can know what is going on in this base and was able to target the base in more than one way. Even the reality of targeting this base via drones and missiles is also of higher importance.
We will mention this out of fear of Hezbollah's response, as claimed by the Hebrew media. They claim that the crime of assassinating the martyr Wissam Tawil has been within the framework of the rules of war which are currently in place on the northern front of the occupied Palestine, and it's not been beyond them. So Mr. Zahir Abu Hamdi, the Zionist, stressed that the crime of assassinating the martyr Wissam al-Tawil did not go beyond the current rules of war.
They promote it. They are promoting the rules of engagement. What are the rules of engagement? Is it only about distance and depth, or is it also about the issue of assassinations and killings? I mean, it seems that the occupation has currently moved to another stage of the issue of targeting and assassinations. The assassination of specific figure, regardless of whether it is the martyrdom of leaders in Beirut or even the current assassination of al-Tawil, and of course the killings in West Asia and also in Gaza. The issue of assassinations was also one of the red lines, and Hezbollah is concerned with responding to it. Indeed, it will revenge. I believe that the issue of the response may be varied, but the issue of the rules of engagement is not laid only by the occupation. Hezbollah also draws up rules regarding southern Lebanon.
The bombing of the strategic Mehran airbase by Hezbollah as an initial response to the assassination of the martyr Saleh al-Aruri in the southern suburb of Beirut was accurate, according to the Hebrew media. The targeted strategic Mehran military base is the occupation army's air and electronic base, and Hezbollah tried to blind the army's eye. There were many comments on Hezbollah's bombing of the strategic Mehran airbase on Israeli social media, and here are some of them.
Wimberg. Hezbollah attacked the 506th Regional Air Force Base on Mount Meron. I'm sure this was terrible.
Hillel.
Hezbollah severely injured the protective domes on Mount Meron and, in parallel, damaged the credibility of the Israeli army spokesman, who did not respond at all to the severe injury, and not for the first or second time.
Amit?
100,000 Israelis were displaced from their homes, and Mount Meron was bombed for the first time in history. Well done.
Hin?
They will continue to rain missiles on the base until we are blind enough to what is happening in the north, and then they will attack as they did in Gaza.
Roni Itan.
A strategic facility receives two direct hits at the most critical point.
Ozi.
This is a day with a new vision of launching cornered missile towards the airbase.
Professor Zahir Abu Hamdi, why does the military censorship impose a blackout on the extent of the damage that befell the Mehran airbase? And how do you explain this confusion that exists amongst the occupation army in responding to questions about the damage that was inflicted on this military base?
The issue of reasons for military censorship, when the issue is imposed, means that the goal is very vital, important, and strategic. Most importantly, it also indicates that the Israeli public does not know about this rule and does not know its importance. Therefore, for example, Hezbollah documented this operation and its importance and explained to the people, its audience, and the enemy as well, the significance, the importance of this military base and broadcast its videos for the Israeli public. This somewhat undermined the trust between the public and the army. In addition to all of this, the attack on this military base, while being important, tells us about Hezbollah's adherence to its promise to take revenge from the occupation regime. In the first level, this attack practically blinded the eyes of the regime, which was very near and absolutely treacherous. There were cameras. These were very large and very expensive cameras. In fact, one of the cameras represented was estimated at $500,000. In addition, it has now joined the farthest, strongest, and most important place. Not only this military base is strategic, it is also responsible for surveillance and monitoring, and of course, air traffic.
Okay, but what about the Safed base?
About Safed base? But first, I think that the past 3 days, there were three important attacks on the Meron base. The cruise missile attack in Haifa by the Iraqi resistance should also be mentioned, although the occupation has denied it. But it did happen, even if we refuse to talk about it all. I mean, it is very much clear among the resistance groups that there has been a vital missile attack in Haifa Bay. The second attack was against Dadu military base, which is in Safed city. We should note that today, the resistance has moved to a higher stage and is attacking more significant targets further away. I mean, the attacks are not limited to border military bases anymore. It should also be noted that we are talking about military bases and not civilian bases. There is a very huge difference between these two, especially if you look at it from a political point of view or the rules of engagement.
In addition to the ongoing U.S.-Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip, which has not yet achieved its goals of liquidating the Palestinian resistance and returning Zionist families by force, in the north and the south of the Strip, the occupation forces are still unable to resolve this on-the-ground battle. The goals of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip are unachievable. So the goals of the aggression against the Gaza Strip were not achieved, even if the leaders of the Palestinian resistance and Hamas are killed. These words come from Dan Halutz.
It is true, because basically, what are the goals of the U.S.-Israeli genocide against Gaza? I mean, even Netanyahu, Gallant, or the War Cabinet have set the goals, and it is clear now that the most well-known goal is eliminating Hamas. But most important of all, how is it possible to eliminate an idea or a thought, which is essentially a resistance idea? Most important of all is that the occupation, in its three or four stages, and in addition to the fourth stage, was somewhat ahead of time. The first stage was the preliminary fire and aerial bombardment, and this stage took approximately 20 days, but they believe that it did not take enough time. The second stage was the ground invasion, and the ground invasion also was in stages, and currently in Khan Yunis there is a war situation, and it cannot advance further, as well as in the north. And the third stage, which is the topic of conversations these days, is the stage of surgery, assassinations, or something similar. The third stage is the political stage. But in any of these stages of the war, they have not achieved the desired goals for each stage, let alone all the stages of the war.
The failure of the occupation army to return the captives as promised has prompted the families of the captives to escalate their protest against Netanyahu and his administration, with a new phase of protests starting next week. It is clear, Mr. Zahir Abu Khamdi, that the disappointment of the captives' families and their return to their homes is very great. But to what extent can their protest against the Netanyahu administration grow and create a pressure in the end?
The internal Israeli division is very important, and this is one of the factors behind the siege on October 7th. But the most important thing is that to some extent now the Israeli political arena has become divided.
We, even in the war cabinet, will find that there are five people there: Netanyahu, Golan, Ron Dermer, Benny Gantz, and Gadi Eisenkot, together with some, in contrast currently.
In your opinion, this will be reflected by the family files?
Certainly, and most importantly, the resistance understands the Israeli mentality. That's why every day we receive videos in Hebrew and messages that demand for demonstrations. They announce that Netanyahu has abandoned them. Not a week or a day or three will pass without there being a video or a message from the captives' families calling for demonstrations. The key point here is that during the early days of the demonstrations, they were in small numbers, but today they have grown into thousands or tens of thousands of protesters. In some areas, we are witness to even more than one demonstration on the same day. This will also not only reflect on the Israeli public and on the regime, but will also contribute to the disintegration of current administration and the war cabinet. And I believe that in the coming days, perhaps Gantz and Eisenkot will withdraw from the war cabinet.
The failure to achieve the goals of the Israeli aggression emerged as disagreements between the occupation leaders within the war cabinet and the administration come to the surface. This was while a campaign was launched against the chief of staff, who was confronted by Minister Gantz. The words from Gantz, the divisive language of some ministers and members of the war cabinet, resulted in criticism from many commentators in the Hebrew media, to the point that they requested a lie detector system at ministerial meetings. Israeli social media also had a role in these internal Zionist disputes, and these are some of the comments we monitored.
Danieli.
Reminder. Gantz brought in Herzi as the same chief of staff he was on October 7th.
Rashili.
This administration will be remembered as the worst administration. I hope it does not cause us more disasters.
Gilad.
It is clear that the ministers are stressed by the investigation, afraid of what will be discovered.
Ya'al.
We did not succeed in achieving success with Hamas inside Gaza, so we began trying to achieve some success outside Gaza.
Or,
for what they are defending, the chief of staff is 100% guilty, and they are silent and embarrassed.
Professor Zahir Abu Hamdi, what is the background of these disputes between the regime ministers and the war cabinet? Why would they act like this at this time? What are the effects of these disputes, as it was stipulated a moment ago in the course of the aggression on the Gaza Strip?
Now, the Israeli public is attacking the army. And most importantly, the prime minister is attacking the army. The minister of war and the minister of security in Israel are also attacking the army. There are also huge gaps and very big problems between Halevi and Galant. And the most important thing is that its influence on the field, the army, has decreased for about a month and a half, and it wants to stop the fighting, leaving Gaza and acquiesce in political settlements. We have seen the signs in more than one occasion. Indeed, when it's confessed to what happened in Shojaiya and the killing of the four prisoners, and then it's said that there was a friendly fire which has killed Israeli soldiers, or even speaking of the Israeli aircraft which killed Israeli prisoners in Gaza. In fact, one way or another, the army is telling the Israeli public to go demonstrate to stop the war in Gaza. Actually, it was speaking out about things and the reality on the ground. I mean, I don't know any army in the world which within one day acknowledges that there is an investigation and then publishes that investigation and says the details. Even about one Israeli soldier who was killed, they said he was killed by fungus. What is this, a fungal infection for which there is no cure? They want to say that this Gaza has become a prophecy and they must get out of it immediately. There are leaks. These leaks, in my opinion, the one responsible for them is the army. The army is the one that works against Israeli measures for military censorship. The army leaks information that puts pressure on Netanyahu and puts pressure on the war cabinet. In addition, the secret and unauthorized networks of power in Israel are not just there to watch what happened in the Supreme Court regarding
regarding the reasonableness law. Imagine, for example, that the pressure on Netanyahu also increases in the judiciary, and that they even set a date for him to resume the corruption trial. We're facing not only vertical or horizontal divisions there. In fact, there are huge gaps, fragmentations, and disintegration. Even before the war broke out, there were two camps in Israel, but today we see there are camps within the regime. And if this conflict and these divisions expand to the security services and the Mossad, and then to the army, we will refer to it as the pinnacle of the victory of the October 7th operation.
Consequently, this will affect the course of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Thank you very much for participating in this episode of Israel Watch. Journalist Mr. Zahir Abu Hamdi, and thank you for following up. God bless you.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The widespread destruction of historical sites in Gaza by the Zionist regime deprives Palestinians of physical representations of their history and memories. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, the material loss Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have suffered in 3 months of the Zionist regime's bombing is unprecedented. Not only have they lost their homes, entire neighborhoods and civilian infrastructure, but residents say another immeasurable damage that cannot be repaired has been the erasure of Gaza's history. Since the beginning of its war on Gaza on October 7th, the Zionist regime's military has targeted and destroyed dozens of heritage sites, including historic churches and mosques, cultural museums, and archaeological structures that date back thousands of years. Key religious sites have been a target for the Zionist regime's airstrikes and artillery shelling across the different districts of Gaza. Many of those sites had been transformed into shelters for displaced Palestinians at the time of the attack, resulting in dozens of casualties. On October 18th, the Greek Orthodox Church of St. Porphyrius was damaged by an Israeli regime airstrike on the adjacent 141-year-old Ahli Baptist Hospital, the oldest hospital in the strip. 2 days later, it was directly targeted by a strike that killed at least 16 people and wounded dozens of others among the families who were taking refuge in the church. Randa Artin, a Christian resident of Gaza, said the church was one of the few religious sites where she and her community would pray and spend religious holidays, since the Zionist regime does not grant them permits to travel to Beit Lah, through the Erez crossing each year. The 53-year-old woman told Middle East Eye, the churches in the Gaza Strip are not many, but all of them are old and historic. So if one church is destroyed, it is not actually one church, it is hundreds of years erased. Unlike any other churches, we had a special spiritual connection with the Greek Orthodox Church in particular. It is a symbol of Palestinian Christians in Gaza and even across Palestine as well. We used to attend Christmas there and light up the tree along with the children every year. It is hard to believe that the few places available for Christians in Gaza are now destroyed. The almost 900-year-old